Mike Pence weighs in on the Iran nuclear deal. How come? Tom Sugar makes a decision on a potential bid for governor. Freedom Indiana launches a new campaign. And Greg Ballard calls for mandatory minimums for gun crimes. That plus Josh McNary's second chance and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 11, 2015.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, Mike Pence signed a letter to the president objecting to the Iran nuclear deal. The governor says it's because the state of Indiana has already placed sanctions on Iran. State pension funds are prohibited from investing or doing business with the government of Iran, and so are state contractors. Pence was in Fort Wayne, where he said that if the Iran nuclear deal is put in place, some of those restrictions could be lifted. The letter to the president says, quote, "The people of our states will not be safer as a result of this agreement." 14 other governors signed it, including Chris Christie, John Kasich, Scott Walker, and Bobby Jindal. They are all Republican presidential candidates. Pence also wrote a second letter to members of the Indiana congressional delegation, urging them to vote against the deal.
As we think about the upcoming session of the General Assembly, we'll be evaluating whether there's additional measures that we ought to consider here in the state of Indiana, and we're actively reviewing that as we speak. But look, my hope is that that Congress will think better of it.
What's behind the governor's objections? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Joel Miller, Republican Murray Clark, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Kenzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm WishTV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Joel Miller, is the governor's letter partisan?
Absolutely. This is an example of rigid ideology and total politics. I wish he would spend some time being governor and quit trying to be a congressman again, pay some attention to our crumbling infrastructure, a drug problem, out-of-control healthcare epidemic in southern Indiana, and instead he's trying to make national news to raise money. It's sad.
You think that's the motive, is raising money?
Absolutely.
Senator Dan Coats has been a vocal opponent of the Iran nuclear deal, and he praised the governor, even issued a news release praising him. But I asked Senator Coats if state sanctions are a big factor in this, and he said no. What's going on?
Well, first of all, the entire Republican delegation is opposed to it. But the deal.
Senator Richard Lugar is not.
I didn't know he was part of the delegation.
He's not, but he is a foreign policy expert, isn't he?
Sure, he is. But I mean, the deal itself says that the federal government, the president, will actively encourage states to do away and rescind state sanctions. So I mean, it is a state issue. Because if the deal goes through, this ill-conceived deal with this state-sponsored terrorist country, then it's the federal government's duty to get states to withdraw on state sanctions.
And if that happens, do you think the state pension fund will invest in the government of Iran?
Well, I think not under this governor, you know, and I hope not under the tenure of any successor governor.
This all seems a little odd, doesn't it?
Yes and no. I'm not sure that the traditional line that was drawn between state policy and state politics and federal and international politics really is much of a line anymore. You know, you used to joke about why is somebody running for fill in the blank, you know, Secretary of State worried about something outside the scope of his or her office. I think that's out the window. Everybody wants to know where everybody stands on every issue. And this one is a volatile issue. It's politically potent. And if you're a Republican governor, I mean, look at the people he signed with. They're all presidential candidates. He was a almost presidential candidate. It's almost part of, you know, it's checking off a box on the, I don't want to say litmus test, but I mean, it's a pretty safe call if you're a Republican governor of a state, Midwestern state.
It's playing to the base.
Well, and as John explains it, it sounds like Joel's point is probably well taken about it being a way to show his conservatism and to also, at a time when he's raising money for his own election coming next year, make sure that the people know where he stands. So I think that there's some of that to this. The other part of this is while the contract or the agreement calls for the federal government to actively seek states to end any sanctions they may have, the states can just say no. And so, you know, if that were ever to come to pass, I'm sure with a Republican legislature and a Republican governor that they wouldn't, bow to the federal's wishes, that the federal government's wishes that Indiana let go of any of the sanctions that it has. So I think it's a moot point.
Well, for you, Joel, let's play devil's advocate. Expressing a thought that's consistent with your beliefs, even though you do it in a public fashion like this, even if it is in order to raise money, what's wrong with that?
Well, I think the problem with it is he's not paying attention and putting time into the real problems that we're facing in Indiana. With the bridges are crumbling and falling, it's not just the bridge on I-65. There are other bridges that are in desperate need of repair that he's completely ignored. The problems that we're having in healthcare, he was too late to respond, and we ended up with an AIDS outbreak in southern Indiana. We have all of these problems that are popping up. The governor reacts later, doesn't react at all. He embarrasses the state with RFRA, and he goes and wades into a major political national issue when he's completely ignoring dealing with the real problems that we're dealing with in Indiana.
Does he need to be concerned about the broader electorate as opposed to the Republican base?
Well, first of all, he signed a letter. I mean, you know, the man can multitask. He's got quite a career. I would argue that he isn't just playing to his base. I would argue that mainstream Hoosiers are not supportive of this deal. And, if you talk to reasonable members of our congressional delegation who looked at the deal, who studied it, who did their due diligence, you know, Congressman Brooks said the more she learned about it, the less she liked it. So, I think it's leadership. I think he is dealing with a mainstream belief among Hoosiers that this is a bad deal.
It's a political freebie, though. I mean, if this deal works out as President Obama hopes, and we won't know until we have more gray hair, in my case, than I do now, so what? No one's going to remember that Mike Pence was one of the governors who opposed this. If, in fact, it doesn't work out and there is evidence that Iran is cheating, guess what? Then you can say, look what I did on such and such a date. I signed this letter, two letters, in fact, Mary, one to the delegation, one so he can not only multitask but do, I guess that's three things maybe at once. But yeah. And as far as paying attention to the state, you look at the other, at least he's the only Republican governor on that list that isn't actively running for president. So if he may have his eyes elsewhere, but
others.
The others really have their eyes elsewhere.
Well, it also plays into the whole politics of cynicism when you get right down to its base.
All right. Tom Sugar made a decision this week regarding a possible run for governor. He didn't announce it. Sugar is a former chief of staff to Senator Evan Bayh, who started testing the waters in the 2016 race for governor in August. That was shortly after he began pushing a bipartisan redistricting plan. He sent a tweet urging supporters to stay tuned. He then emailed me to say that he's on business in Houston and will make an announcement, quote, as soon as I fulfill my previous obligations. John Gregg is the only other Democrat in the race. He declined comment beyond a statement that says he's focused on his campaign. Murray Clark, is that a good strategy?
Well, I don't know about the strategy, but I kind of feel bad for Joel. I mean, this is a clear sign to me that Democrats aren't solidified behind John Gregg. You know, and this isn't out of a mainstream individual talking about running for governor. This is the chief of staff of the patriarch and the godfather of Hoosier Democrats. I mean, this can't be a good sign for John Gregg.
Is this a sign of trouble?
No, I don't think it's a sign of trouble at all. John Gregg has solidified nearly every Democratic-based support group that he needs to solidify. He's raising money. He's moving forward. The part that I find amusing about what Murray said is that in the same week that it was announced that Mayor Greg Ballard is considering a run for governor against the incumbent Republican governor, that people are sort of whispering that that's a possibility. A former chief of staff versus a sitting mayor of the largest city in Indiana considering a run for governor. I think we're in a pretty good position compared to the position of the Republican Party.
And you know, Tom Sugar may have a connection to Evan Bayh, but certainly he doesn't have much name ID, doesn't have the resume that you would look for in a candidate for governor in all likelihood. He's trying to build suspense here, is that?
Well, obviously he's trying to build suspense, and I think it's kind of an interesting strategy because, you know, my thought is if you're planning to run or not to run, then you don't say stay tuned. So it sounds like he's planning to run. My question is
yeah, you wouldn't do this if you weren't going to run, right?
But it's not this. We all think he's been talking about governor, and he has, but there's another seat on that ticket, and that's for Secretary of State. And so, you know, maybe he's going to throw us a little curveball here in a week or so, or whenever it is that he decides to make the announcement.
Okay. Well, you know, chances are by the time some people see this program, he's already made the announcement. But I assume that this means that he's running for governor.
I would agree. I think John's assessment is exactly right. Why else would you dangle this carrot and, you know, pique your interest? I mean, next time, if he doesn't...
And his 160 Twitter followers, so...
Is it up to 160 now? That's 160 more than I have, I guess.
That is as backhanded as I've heard in a long time.
We've said before. I mean, he's a legitimate. He's a good thinker. He has the political connections, right. The pedigree that Murray said.
I agree.
But the problem is, there's a big head start now that's been ceded to John Gregg. John Gregg's been very successful raising money, and unless Tom Sugar is able to tap into Evan Bayh's rather significant financial reserves, which you indicated in your story, is probably not going to happen.
I have a source who tells me that Evan Bayh has made it clear to everyone involved that he's not taking sides.
Well,
in
then I think the answer is he's
so
got
$10 million is safe. Yeah,
that's a new position.
Oh, man.
Thwack.
Another one.
All right. Moving on. We'll let you know what Tom Sugar decides. Freedom Indiana is gearing up for a new equal rights battle in the 2016 General Assembly. Chris Paulson will manage a campaign aimed at winning approval for statewide protections based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Freedom Indiana is a political action committee that has been dormant since the RFRA battle in the spring. Here's Paulson.
Gay and transgender people in Indiana can be fired, denied service, and denied housing for being gay and transgender. And we want to fix that so Indiana is seen as welcoming for all.
John Kenzenberger, will this battle start on Organization Day?
If it doesn't start sooner than that, but the speculation is that the Republicans and the General Assembly are working on a plan that they would like to introduce at Organization Day with the idea of getting it passed. And I think the theory that if they get it taken care of then, it becomes a non-issue. But it's going to be interesting to see what the plan is. We've been hearing what the Republicans have been talking about. There is a model in Utah that they are paying attention to, but Freedom Indiana has made it very clear that they want a simple answer to this, and we'll hear the phrase over and over, four words and a comma.
That's right.
They just want to add...
Sexual orientation, comma, gender identity.
They just want to add that to
the
state's non-discrimination law, and so that's where the argument will be.
Yeah, I mean, no Organization Day, that may be yet another mile marker or milestone here, but as John suggests, I think the battle, not only will it start before then, I'd argue it's already started. I mean, this is just yet another manifestation of how serious both sides are when you start investing in an infrastructure in terms of staffing and hiring is going to be ramping up for that organization. This is already underway, if you ask me.
Will Republican supermajorities go along with more protections?
Well, I guess that remains to be seen. I mean, you characterize this group as being dormant. I don't think anybody's been dormant on this. I think everybody's preparing for this discussion, and I think it will happen in Organization Day or before. I think the governor's people spent the summer trying to take a deep dive into issues like this issue and positions of Hoosiers and Hoosier groups. I think the legislative leaders on the Republican side are getting ready for the fight, and they are looking at ways to to take care of the issue as soon as possible.
To make sure it's not a campaign issue in 2016.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is an election year in 2016. Now, that can cut both ways. I mean, you know, right. there's some very, very conservative, particularly rural districts that maybe have a different slant on this than in some of the urban areas.
Well, Mike Pence is the key here because if you get it through the legislature, you're going to need him to sign it. His staff keeps saying that he's studying the issue, listening to Hoosiers, and he has an open mind. What does that say to you?
It says his staff has never met Mike Pence. I think that the only reason this is being explained and described as a battle is because the Republicans are in charge of the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. If Democrats were in charge, this would have been passed a long time ago. This is an issue of right and wrong. The Republican Party, their platform is wrong on this, their leadership is wrong on this, and even if they get it what they're calling right, it's going to be a try to split the baby and thread the needle rather than just doing the right thing and adding four words.
You're saying they won't add all four?
Correct.
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, I think you have divergent opinions on this issue in the Republican caucus. And I think when it all came down, you had some folks that wanted to repeal the law rather than go to the fix and so forth. And really, the fix was kicking the can down the road, which was a good thing for Indianapolis. So
at that point,
I think it remains to be seen.
Indianapolis Mayor Greg Ballard said this week that there is a way to reduce gun violence. He said it's pretty obvious what needs to be done.
Homicides in 2014 would have been dramatically less, if we had mandatory minimum sentences for using a gun in the commission of crime.
Ballard suggested that a 20-year mandatory minimum is a good idea. John Schwanes, is that practical?
I don't know if it's practical. Certainly, when he says obviously there's a solution, I guess you could carry it to its ridiculous extreme and say, you know, incarcerate everybody on their first infraction of any felony charge or conviction. That would reduce crime. I mean, you're taking people off the streets, but there is, as
you
suggest...
You're building a lot of prisons.
Well, as you suggest, Jim, that's not necessarily fiscally reasonable. And it also runs somewhat against sort of what we've been seeing as an overarching change in philosophy about, and more so in the drug arena, where it comes mm-hmm. treating things less as crime, lock them up the key kind of offenses, and more with rehab. And I think even though this is a somewhat different animal, you're still hearing talk about guiding young people into different paths, finding ways, alternatives. But you're still going to have an appetite for lock them up and throw away the key. But I mean, he's right. It would reduce crime, I guess, if you're willing to pay for it.
But this didn't. We just went through a whole
right.
2-year process of changing prison sentences, and it didn't come up.
Well,
or
the direction
certainly didn't dominate.
The direction has been away from determinant sentences in this whole process, and so for the mayor to call for basically a determinant sentence goes against the flow of the legislative will at this point. He's right. I guess that would possibly help, but I think a more effective means is to get more of the guns off the street and out of the hands of criminals. And there are various ways that have been done in the past to try to get that done. That's not a popular and that's a very difficult thing to do, but that would probably be more effective than going against the flow of determinant sentencing at this point.
The mayor is serving out his term, not running for re-election. He's got a 66% approval rating. So is he trying to leverage that position?
I'm sure he is. But if I'm Greg Ballard and I've been the mayor during the crime wave that he's been the mayor during, I would probably blame the judiciary when the fact of the matter is that I haven't hired enough police officers, we're understaffed, and I built a $6 million, $7 million cricket stadium. I would find someone else to blame, too.
Is that fair?
Of course it's not fair. What kind of question is that? You know, what I really like about Greg Ballard is he doesn't stick his finger up in the air. I mean, truth be known, he's not particularly concerned about what the folks at the legislature think about his ideas. I mean, it is. The question was originally, is it practical? Well, it's not practical. I've been there. I tried gun legislation one time when I was there. I didn't even get a committee hearing, you know. So, but I mean, he feels passionate and about the issue, and so much of the crime has been committed by folks with firearms, particularly juveniles, which is really a big problem.
Well, you shouldn't suggest he's a lone voice, because even though you're right, the General Assembly push has been in an opposite direction. You have had high-profile members of the General Assembly, Jim Merritt, for instance, who I think in each of the past few sessions has proposed something very similar, if not identical, to this in terms of the duration of minimum
sentence. It's very expensive,
but
it's hard.
You just said the key word, a lot of the crime committed by juveniles, and he's saying mandatory minimum sentences to throw these kids in prison for 20 years so that they come out good and hard criminals. It doesn't make sense.
Well, there are no easy answers.
I mean, they're in terms of juvenile crime in areas like Boston and other places where municipalities have more power to change criminal statutes, there have been initiatives for juveniles, if they're caught with a firearm, to go to, not to prison, but to juvenile detention for 180 days or the like.
That's why the crime issues are so frustrating for probably elected officials and voters alike, because if you have crumbling infrastructure, you talked about earlier, you can theoretically pour money at it, fix it relatively quickly. You have poverty, you can throw money at it. You can't necessarily combat crime effectively in a short period of time with any magic wand. It just doesn't work that way.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, do you support mandatory minimum sentences for gun crimes? Your choices are A, yes, B, no, or C, judges need discretion. Last week's question, does the Blue Indy service make sense? 27% said yes, 39% said no, 34% said time will tell. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. The method of electing judges in Marion County is illegal. That's the finding of a federal appeals court this week in a lawsuit filed by Common Cause. The current system allows each major party to nominate candidates for half the judicial vacancies. As a result, if you win the primary, you win in the fall. Joel Miller, what happens next?
There aren't judicial elections until 2018, so there'll be time to deal with this issue. But I would be fine with electing judges in Marion County the way every other county elects judges, which would be if we have 18 positions up, the top 18 vote getters are the judges, and they sit on the bench. Every county does it that way, but Marion, I'm fine with that project.
But you've had a circumstance here where the party bosses had their way, right?
Not necessarily. This system came out of a legislative compromise.
All right.
The reason it came out as Les Duvall in the 1970s, you had a 1970 election, all judges, Superior Court judges, and the Circuit Court judges, for that matter, were Republican. 74 is a Watergate election year. All the Republicans are out. All the Democrats come in. 78, Republicans in, Democrats out. Senator Les Duvall thought that was no way to run a railroad. I mean, so I really understand the legal theory behind this decision. I hate to see it happen, because it was born out of all the best intentions of a really good legislator who was also a lawyer.
And you think it was working?
Yeah, I mean, I think better that, I think continuity on the bench is meaningful, and quality on the bench is important.
Does it get fixed before the 2018 election?
Well, you're asked to. I mean, this is statute, the setup now. Yeah. So, as far as I know, the Federal Appeals Court isn't in a position to craft its own solution, so it almost is a necessity.
If it strikes down the law, though, it would revert to what Joel said. But with a Republican majority in the governor, I mean, the implication that Joel failed to illuminate here is that it's likely the vast majority of those judges will be elected are Democrats, and the Republicans in the legislature don't want that to happen.
Yeah. Stay tuned. Finally, Josh McNary was acquitted of rape last week. He was named to the practice squad for the Indianapolis Colts this week. McNary is an NFL player once again. It's what jury foreman Ken Faulkner wanted to see. He says that during the rape trial, he was convinced that McNary is an honest man. He says he didn't know anything about his football career until after the trial, but now wants to see him succeed.
I think he's a good football player. I can see him, if things work out right, I can see him 25, 30 years down the line being in the Hall of Fame.
The first thing I did was, once he was exonerated, called him and said, how much do you weigh? Are you in shape?
And that's Colts general manager Ryan Grigson. Murray Clark, does Josh McNary deserve a second chance?
I know nothing about this case, but I'm with the jurist. He saw it firsthand, right? We live in this world of everybody's an instant expert and everybody makes a decision without the facts. So I'd say, yeah.
The jury system worked?
Apparently. We have to trust the system, and that's the answer that they came out with. I wasn't in the room, and I don't think you were either, so we have to trust that the decision was right.
That's right. How are the Colts going to do this year?
Well, I hope they do well, especially in the wake of what happened with those evil New England Patriots.
How does he get that question? I know.
Let him answer the same
just
question.
Just the lucky one, right?
How are the Colts going to do this year?
They're going to win everything. There.
He's wearing his Colts suit.
Yeah.
Come on.
12 wins and a Super Bowl berth, and we'll see what happens.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Joel Miller, Republican Murray Clark, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.